Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do it. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
MintMobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 531.24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
Look, Bumble knows you're exhausted by dating. All the must not take yourself too seriously and 6-1 since that matters. And what do I even say other than, hey? Well, that's why they're introducing an all-new Bumble. With exciting features to make compatibility easier, starting the chat better, and dating safer. They've changed, so you don't have to. Download the new Bumble now.
Hello and welcome to the How To Academy podcast, the bi-weekly show from London's home of big thinking. I'm Vas Christodoulou. Our guest on this episode, Gemma Newman, is a medical doctor who believes in treating the whole self, mind, body and soul. She tells us how in a new book called Get Well, Stay Well, and she joined Hannah McInnes for a livestream conversation a few weeks back to tell us more. Enjoy.
You write in the introduction about various worrying statistics in today's society concerning health, concerning physical, mental health, and we'll come to how interlinked those are, that were the prompt for really what you do and who you are as a doctor, and really therefore this book. So I just wonder if you could outline what this really is an antidote to, I suppose.
Thank you, Hannah. Yes. So what I loved about what you said earlier was that it was like a friend, and that's what I feel as though I want people to get from the book. In my 20 years of clinical practice, I gradually understood how challenging it is to help people feel better. And, you know, I see this all the time where, I mean, perhaps I'm not unique in thinking this. When I was fresh out of medical school, I thought, well, I had all of the tools I needed, all the protocols, all the medications. I just needed to tell my patients what to do and they'd listen and everything would be fine. Well, obviously, after 20 years of clinical practice, I learned that life is not so straightforward. We are complicated humans. We don't fit into boxes. And sadly, over the years, I've also noticed that our mental and physical health has been on the decline. As you said, I've seen more and more patients with mental health struggles, issues with their self-esteem, issues with anxiety, increasing rates of autoimmune conditions, increasing rates of depression, even increasing rates of things that you might not even think about, such as bowel cancer, for example. And of course, our biggest killers in the Western world, heart disease, cancer, diabetes, lung disease, are still very much key in all the things I see day to day. And so for me, what I really wanted to do was to help my patients have a friend, hopefully help them to need to see me a little bit less, and also give them some tools that are completely free that might reduce their long-term risk of developing some of these conditions, which was something that was really important to me, because in general practice, obviously, we see people from cradle to grave. We see them from, you know, I see newborn babies, I see elderly, frail, vulnerable, and everybody in between. And time and again, I've discovered that our mental health, our physical health, our emotional health, our spiritual health are all very much linked. And I think what was so important to me in this book was to give people practical tools that were evidence-based that they could bring into their lives that would be completely free and may improve the quality and quantity of their life.
It's interesting, yes, because I was really struck by the image at the front here, which is, if people can see it, a stethoscope and a plant. And I wonder if you feel a bit of a lone voice in being a GP. You're talking about things that you say are free, that are accessible, because this world, a holistic approach to wellness, these sorts of words are often seen, aren't they, as very elitist, I'm sure, and many people, you'll be preaching to the converted. But Do you feel that there are many GPs like you within Western medicine who are advocating a more holistic approach as you are?
I think it's interesting you asked that question. I think when I started out, I felt very much like a lone wolf. But as the years have gone by, I've actually discovered that there is a community of healthcare professionals who are really seeking other ways to help their patients other than the ways that we usually would. It's a real challenge, Hannah, because we don't have much time. We have dwindling resources. We have dwindling workforce. And a lot of GPs are feeling quite burnt out. There's a phenomenon that I like to call a moral injury, where my colleagues are feeling that they just can't provide the care that they want to provide within the paradigm that we currently have. And it really does impact their mental health. So in this book, I actually want my fellow doctors to read this book, because I did a talk around the themes of the book for a group of GPs talking about their own mental health. And I had some feedback that there was a GP in particular that went to the talk, and she was so moved and inspired that she started to do some of these exercises in her own life. And it actually meant that she decided to stay at work. She was about to quit. She was about to give it up because she felt so overwhelmed, so burnt out, but she decided to stay. And that was after the mental health talk that I gave, talking about some of the things in this book. So that really struck me, because I thought, we all need this. We all need this. And yeah. I get really frustrated, actually, when I see, you know, the whole wellness world and, you know, the biohackers and the people that spend a fortune, the worried well, they spend a fortune on all sorts of devices, equipment. And I feel like I don't want the people that can't afford that to feel that they can't get well or stay well, because it's possible, you know, with the right sort of information, it's really possible for them to take some of these things on, and it doesn't have to cost a fortune. And I think that's what I really wanted to share with my patients, because many of them don't have a lot of money. I work in a small town very close to Heathrow Airport, and I see a lot of deprivation, a lot of social deprivation. And I understand it's really challenging for my patients. They don't have resources. They don't have the mental bandwidth sometimes even to make changes. But with some of the tips that I share in this book, they have. And that's what I find just so magical. That's why I share some of my patient stories, so to show people that it is possible to make changes and it doesn't have to cost you a fortune.
No. When I listen to you saying that, I think of something that I write in the margins time and time again as a query, which is that it doesn't have to cost you a fortune, but to set off on any sort of journey, you have to be committed and you do have to find a fair amount of time. Would that be right?
I think that time is the most, I suppose it's the most underappreciated asset that we have. You have to make the time for yourself, which is hard to do. And that's why I think I emphasize in the book the importance of finding those positive emotions for yourself. Because if you are able to feel a genuine positive self-regard, or at least get on the road to feeling that, then it means that you are more likely to want to make the time for yourself to start doing some of these things. And that's why I added a few journal pages in the back, because I thought if someone doesn't have a journal or they don't have a place where they could just start writing their thoughts, they can do it in the book rather than having to get another one.
Yeah. And let's talk about, you know, what's in there, because there are lots of things that are, once people have committed to reading it and to making those changes, there are lots of things that are so, well, they are so simple. To explain gloves, which is really the backbone of the whole book, what gloves stands for and how that came about.
Yeah. So gloves is my acronym for my healthy framework. And it stands for gratitude, love, outside, veggies, exercise, and sleep. So I'll say that again in case you didn't catch it. Gratitude, love, outside, veggies, exercise, and sleep. And the reason that I wanted to put gratitude and love at the beginning is because very often, you know, we sort of know some of the things that we should do or we feel we should do, but it's quite hard to find the emotional space to get started. And so gratitude and love were the very forefront of the plan because I wanted people to understand the value of these emotions and the value of aiming to include them day to day in order that you can make some of the other changes more easily. And it came about really through inspiration for one of my patients. She's a nurse and she came to see me with some eczema. She had a nasty latex allergy and she's obviously wearing latex gloves every day at work. And I told her, well, obviously you've got this latex allergy, so you can change over to non-latex gloves. I gave her some emollient moisturizing creams. And that could have been that. That would have been enough probably. But I wanted to ask her a few more questions and delve a bit deeper into her lifestyle because I could see that she had a history of eczema on and off as well. She had other issues with regard to her sort of immune health and her thyroid and things like that. So I was just asking her a little bit about her life. And she, you know, she was living a very chaotic life. She was a busy nurse. She lived in a flat share. She didn't make time to sit down, have breakfast, dinner. She'd rush to work. She'd grab a croissant and a coffee on the way to work. Maybe a ham sandwich when she got there. She would never sit to eat. She wouldn't prioritize her sleep. She wasn't prioritizing moving her body other than just rushing around at work. And, she was a party girl, you know, she worked hard, she played hard and she sort of stayed out late at the weekends and so on. So just talking it through with her, I just asked her if there were other things that she could do to support her lifestyle and what she felt she could bring into her life. And what she felt she could do was to start batch cooking on a Sunday so that she had a few meals to eat in the week that weren't a takeaway. She would set an alarm to make sure she went to bed an hour earlier than she usually would intend to during the week. And she made a promise that she would sit down to eat. And these sound like quite small things, but it's actually quite hard to do all those things consistently. But she made a promise that that's what she was going to do. And amazingly, the next time I saw her, her general eczema had also really improved as well. And also other aspects of her immune health had improved and her thyroid function as well. And it just got me thinking, you know, there are so many ways in which we can help ourselves that we don't necessarily appreciate will have a long-term effect on our health, but they really can. So that's why I wanted to include simple tips like that in the book that people can think, oh, well, yeah, maybe I'll do that one or I could try and do that one and then write them in and make it part of their own plan.
I mean, the G, let's just look at the G. I look at the clock and think, oh, there's so many questions to ask and we won't get through them all. But we'll start with the G. And many people would think, I think, for the G for gratitude and the L for love, how strange that a doctor is prescribing me these things. And I think a lot of people think of gratitude. You know, we're hearing more and more about journaling and writing gratitude journal, but they think of that quite separately as something they can do as a kindness to themselves. But how can gratitude be almost something prescriptive for health benefits?
Yeah, it's interesting. You don't hear many doctors talking about gratitude. When I looked at the studies on gratitude, it became clear that having a focus on gratitude in life, and especially with regard to journaling, can actually impact our physical health as well as our mental health. There was an interesting study on people that were keeping gratitude journals who had long-term chronic pain conditions. And there was some really interesting evidence that for a proportion of those people, their chronic pain actually improved compared to just keeping a general journal and compared to just the control group, which was therapy alone. So there are some clear physiological benefits to gratitude. But for me, what I wanted to really approach in this chapter was also integrating our challenges, our suffering, our grief in a way that means that we can actually move through them and use them in a really effective way. So often you can hear people say, oh, yeah, you've just got to be grateful. And I don't subscribe to this sort of almost what you call toxic positivity. I think it's important to actually recognize that we suffer. Life is really challenging. Some of us will suffer very young. Some of us will suffer later in life, but we will all suffer. And that's actually the harsh reality that I've sort of seen in my clinical practice. You know, we all die and we all lose loved ones and we all feel loss in other ways, whether it's loss of identity, loss of relationships. These are powerful things that we have to go through, and it's part of living. And so what I wanted to do in this chapter was not only help people understand the power of gratitude to help lift our physical and mental health, but also the power of integrating all of our emotions, the power of being able to accept the grief that we feel and move through it in the best way that we can. So this chapter also has a lot of practical tools, things like the meaning maker exercise, for example, or the emotional tie cutting exercise.
This episode of the podcast is sponsored by Marquee TV. Marquee TV is an incredible streaming service that is a gateway to arts and culture. With my subscription, I've enjoyed watching some of the Royal Shakespeare Company's most acclaimed productions of recent years, including David Tennant in Richard II and Simon Russell Beale in The Tempest. I've seen multiple productions of The Ring Cycle and Thelonious Monk playing in Brussels in 1963. I've watched Alice in Wonderland at the Royal Opera House and Giselle at La Scala. Marquee TV really is the most accessible way into culture I've ever encountered, and a treasure trove for any arts lover. You can try it for 3 months for just 99p. Yep, 3 months for 99p with the code HOWTO. Just visit marquee.tv and use the promo code HOWTO to dive into the world of the arts like never before.
Your brain needs support, and new Ollie Brainy Chews are a delightful way to take care of your cognitive health. Made with scientifically backed ingredients like Thai ginger, L-theanine, and caffeine, Brainy Chews support healthy brain function and help you find your focus, stay chill, or get energized. Be kind to your mind and get these nootropic chews at Ollie.com. That's OLLY.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
Can you explain the meaning maker, because it's really interesting for many people, whether you're dealing with a grief or a bereavement or just generally. The meaning maker is a really instructive, like so many of your tools in the book.
Yeah, so what it does is it helps you to understand where stories come into play and how you can perhaps change the stories you tell yourself in order to improve your chances of healing. So as an example, we all go through things in life, and there's also certain stories we tell ourselves about those things. And sometimes those stories can feel empowering, and sometimes they can feel very emotional, sometimes they can feel negative, sometimes they can feel positive. The meaning maker exercise aims to be a cognitive exercise where you strip away all of the meaning that you have given to the events that you are procrastinating over. And you give yourself permission to just write the facts of the events. Then you have the chance to write down a potential new meaning, if you wish to, that you can give to the events that you are thinking about in order to help you heal and move forward. So sometimes it helps to have an example. So I'll share one of my patients that did this exercise. There was a patient of mine who was having headaches, and he has a very good life. He didn't have any sort of worries or any particular anxiety that he could say. We went through all the different causes of headaches. We established that there was nothing more serious going on. I diagnosed him with tension headaches, and we really tried to get to the root of what was going on for him. And he couldn't think of anything. He was going to the gym. He had a newborn baby son. He was really happy. His marriage was good. So then I just asked him to have a think about, you know, the last thing that was on his mind before he went to bed. And he said, "Oh, my father." I said, "What do you mean? You know, what's going on with your father?" He said, "Well, I don't have a relationship with him at the moment. He betrayed me. He thinks I'm a fool. He tried to get me to lend him money over and over again. And he, you know, he's basically been lying to me for years." I said, "Okay, all right, let's just write down the simple facts of what happened with you and your father." And he just wrote down, "My father asked me for money. And my father did not tell me the truth about his finances. Those were the two overriding facts. But the story, obviously, that he told himself around those facts was quite vivid because of all the emotions he had attached to them, you know, the fear and the betrayal and things like that. So when he'd written down the bare facts of the situation, I asked him to think about, was there anything that he had learned about himself or life in general that he felt that was valuable after the experiences that he'd had with his father? And he started to think about it, and he was thinking, well, I actually really value the importance of honesty and integrity in my relationships, and I hadn't realized that before. And I really value the fact that I'm a father now, and I can see that it must have been hard for him to be a dad, and now I'm a dad, I'm really feeling what it must have been like when I was young. And I was like, okay. And he said, oh, I'm just really glad that I got the chance to, you know, build more positive relationships with other family members that I hadn't really built before. I was like, okay. And he came up with all these different things that he felt were positive that had come from the experience that he felt was negative. And he wrote them down, and then we left it. And then the next time I saw him, it was amazing. His headaches had gone. And, you know, we talked about it subsequently. He decided to write his father a forgiveness letter, which is one of the exercises as well in the book. I don't know if he sent the forgiveness letter at this point. When I wrote the book, he hadn't sent it. Sometimes you don't necessarily have to send these letters, but it can really help you to process your own emotions just by writing them. And so, yeah, that was one of the things he did as well. And it just makes a big difference in how you process what goes on in your life, and how you decide to move forwards, even if something is completely out of your control.
I feel like I don't want to skip past two of the things in that particular chapter, but I want to hold on to that health benefit of letting go, which is enormous, I think. And many of us might have experienced the loss of serious physical symptoms when we were able to let go of something that was mentally holding us back. But so I'm going to hold on to that thought for love, and just ask you a little bit about something else I find really interesting that you include in this book from a doctor's perspective, which is visualization and manifestation. Because again, words that people associate with a different sort of instruction and not the kind of thing you would sit down and be told in the doctor's office, I was about to say, the doctor's room.
Well, you can call it an office, you can call it a room. Yeah, I know what you mean. It's a very strange concept for a doctor to be talking about with their patients, but there is actually a lot of good evidence that, you know, you don't, I suppose it can depend on the words you use, can't it? If I started to talk about manifestation with my patients, I think that they would probably think that, you know, I was becoming something of a hippie. But it's true that visualization is important, because it's actually one of the tools that I use for my patients to help themselves with their health. It's much easier to imagine a positive future, whether it be something to do with your physical health or your mental health, if you can actually see it in your mind's eye, if you can imagine what that might feel like, what that might look like. And athletes use these techniques all the time. Muhammad Ali, the boxer, used to call it future history, where he would envisage exactly when he would throw the winning punch of a match. Lots of athletes use it for visualizing success when they're in their, you know, respective fields. And so what I want to share with people is, it's not woo-woo. It's basically just using your imagination, using a positive emotion and imagination to imagine something a little bit more positive for yourself. Imagine feeling a different way. Imagine being in a different way. Imagine doing in a different way. And giving space, more of an expansive space to allow you to imagine those things, rather than sort of staying stuck in a certain routine and a rut and a way of doing things, which doesn't always necessarily serve us.
This may be a very particular fascination of mine. It kind of links to routine, but it's something that links also to time and how hard it is in today's day and age to sort of find it. When you sort of advocate doing things like visualization and manifest, do you think there's a time of day that's better to do these things? You know, when do you tell people to sit down? That's what I think we're very bad at doing, finding the discipline to give ourselves the compassion and this sort of self-talk in this way. Journaling, those sorts of things, I think, are the hardest thing for people to fit into their days.
Yeah. Well, it depends on the person. So, for example, someone like yourself, Hannah, do you imagine a time of day that would suit you to sit down for 5 minutes and journal or to visualize something different for your life? Where would that fit into your day?
Well, I'm very fortunate to have done lots of interviews like this with brilliant people, and I aspire always for it to be the morning because I feel like that is the best time for everything like this, because you have the day ahead of you. It's the best time to make these commitments.
Yes. So yes, 100%. Well done. I think the morning is a good time to do it. When you have commitments, children that wake you up at 5 a.m, sometimes that can be hard. So I'll always start where, you know, wherever somebody wants to sort of start, really, because it depends on their own life and their own habits and routines. I know from speaking to my patients that if some of them are working regular night shifts, for example, or if some of them have got very early shifts and they just can't make the time, they have to get up at 4 a.m, then it makes sense to do it later in the day. But it's where it can fit in, and it's different for everybody. I do prefer to do it in the morning. And I'm at a stage now in my life where my children are not waking me up at 5 a.m. So I know that I've got a little bit of me time in the morning in order to do this. But it's harder, I think, for certain groups of people, especially depending on what job you've got, how old your children are, if you've got someone that you're caring for example. You know, it can be hard to fit these things in, but I just think, you know, fitting it in somewhere is better than not doing it at all.
And let's move on to the L. Lots of the themes elide, don't they, between the gratitude and love, and in fact all the way through the book. But I was so struck by the way you described the need for love, and specifically self-love, almost as if when we talk about things like an epidemic of loneliness or modern day malaise, a lack of self-compassion feels like something that feeds into so much and is something that you're most wishing to address. Is that right?
Yes, Hannah, it is. I feel like the world that we live in actually doesn't do much for our self-love. Social media, some, you know, images in magazines, the news. There's a lot of negativity, and there's a lot of, I suppose, a lot of polarizing points of view. And it's actually quite hard to find self-compassion, I think, in the modern world. And I think that that's actually really crucial for us to make the decision to actually improve ourselves in the best way we can. And a lot of the time that's done through self-loathing, thinking, oh, you know, you're not good enough. You need to be, you know, you need to be more achieving, more handsome, more skinny, more muscly, you know, or whatever it is, physiologically, physically, mentally. There's always someone that you can compare yourself to negatively. And what I wanted to really give in this book was the idea that we have all that we need within us. And I know it sounds a bit twee, but, you know, we are love. I think, you know, one of the main purposes of living is to give and receive love. And it's something that we just lose along the way. And so I just wanted to help people come back to that. And one of the ways that they can come back to that is understanding a bit more about their values, the things that are actually important to them, living in alignment with those values. And what does that mean? And how can they engender more of a sense of self-love through those values? Thinking about how we talk about ourselves to ourselves, understanding that our thoughts are not us. Our thoughts are just thoughts generated from our brains, which are trying to protect us, but are not always necessarily accurate. Just having an understanding that ultimately we have so much to give. And I think ultimately, if we can give love, we receive love as well. And that's, yeah, that's really the essence of the chapter. There's lots of practical things in the chapter that I hope people use to help them feel that way. So this is where I talk about the forgiveness letter and the values piece and positive self-talk and finding our purpose and how it doesn't have to be this big lofty plan, you know, in order to find your purpose. The importance of just how we show up each day and how we show up in kindness to other people.
At one point, reflect on the language that we use to talk to ourselves. A very interesting, which I think is very relevant here. And you talk about it, this inner critic that we have that's almost insufferable, so many of us. And I was interviewing Adam Phillips at our How to Change Your Life conference. And he was saying it's actually an insult to our intelligence, these words that we use. There's about three words, he was saying, it's so limited, you know, how we speak to ourselves. And if we just check in with that and try and be kinder and think of bigger and better words, it's such an elementary way to stop beating yourself up with this slightly childlike bullying that we do to ourselves.
That's a really interesting idea, yes. And I agree. I think, and I've said this to patients of mine, and I talk about this with one of the case studies. The way that many of us talk to ourselves, you would never dream of tolerating that from a friend or from a colleague or from anyone else. And yet you expect to live with those nasty inner voices day in, day out. So, yeah. So there's a really important exercise in the book where there are some positive self-talk and positive statements, which I wanted to create those as a way that people could actually relate to a statement and it can feel true to them. Because sometimes if you've got quite a low self-esteem, positive affirmations don't always feel true. You know, so you could say to yourself, oh, I am beautiful, you know, I am strong, or, but you won't necessarily believe it. So I wanted to include some affirmations or some positive statements that were a bit more relatable. So things like, you know, change is inevitable in life, for example, you know, so it's kind of like a positive statement, but it allows space for you to recognize that some things do change. You don't necessarily like all the things that are changing, but it's inevitable and it's okay, as an example. And also there's the positive role modeling, because like you say, we can talk so critically to ourselves. And if you've already got quite a low self-esteem, you may not even believe a lot of these positive statements. So the positive role model exercise is actually quite a nice way to give yourself a positive statement that's actually from somebody else and not from you. So if you can think of somebody in your life who you really admire, who you trust to give honest, grounded advice, then you can imagine what they might say to you. Or if you've got them in your life, you can even ask them, what do they think? And write down the things that they're telling you. But if you don't have anyone like that in your life, you can still do the exercise, but you can imagine somebody that you like or that you think is quite wise, perhaps from a novel or a TV show or a movie, and ask them what they would say to you in the situation that you find yourself facing. And then write that down. And actually, that's a really lovely way of externalizing a thought and imagining what somebody else would say to you, rather than relying on your own inner voice, because sometimes your inner voice can be quite nasty, can't it?
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
I have to ask, and it will be a question that I think many people would put to you reading, you know, all the chapters in your book would be great advice, but what if I'm really suffering? And there will be people who say my self-esteem is so low that I can't just say positive, you know, I can't say positive affirmations, or I can't, you know, find a role model. It's gone beyond that. And they might almost feel patronized by some of that sort of advice. What then? Can this help everyone, or is there a sort of certain limit to these sorts of free tools?
There's definitely a limit to it. And I say many times in the book that if you've experienced something deeply traumatic, then it's extremely important to receive counselling. Ideally, you'd see a counsellor or a psychotherapist. And I actually recommend those tools throughout the book. And I like to recommend things that people can use if they're not quite in the place where they want to reach out to somebody else. And I recommend some of these tools for people who don't feel like they want to see a therapist. So the book is really aiming to be like a friend. It's useful for people that don't feel ready to see a psychotherapist or a counsellor. And it's useful for people who would never see a psychotherapist or a counsellor. And it's also useful for people who see a psychotherapist and or a counsellor. I think that there is an element of usefulness to each of the exercises in the book, and not every one of them will resonate with every person. That's why I created the plan at the back, because what I wanted for people to do was to think, well, okay, I get that. I might want to try that. That looks interesting. Then I'll just stick with that for now and see how I go. And so the personalized plan at the back helps you to find the bits of the book that you resonate with most and see how you can integrate those into your day-to-day life, rather than saying, right, well, you know, it's all great for everybody, because we're all different.
You have some brilliant advice about the power of nature, the benefits of nature, about exercise, but I'm going to move to V for vegetables, because there are some questions I'm so fascinated to ask of you as a doctor. Doctors, I think, increasingly push back on the idea of a 100% plant-based diet, which you and your husband have taken up and which you talk about in the book. And there are lots of worries about nutritional deficiencies and various access to protein, you know, this sort of pushback. But do you advocate, and do you feel like as a GP you would wish to prescribe a plant-based diet to all your patients if you could?
So I am 100% plant-based. I have been for many years. And I think it's fascinating seeing the different levels of pushback over the years that have existed for plant-based eating. And I think if I'm going to be completely evidence-based, I'd say a plant-rich diet and a plant-predominant diet is definitely the healthiest way to eat, based on a variety of studies that we can look at. So mechanistic data, randomized controlled trials, epidemiological data, they all point towards an extremely plant-rich diet as being the most healthy for us in terms of our longevity and prevention of disease. So when I hear pushback, it's usually from people, well, there's a number of different sort of avenues, but it's usually along the lines of, well, how can you possibly get enough protein, or nutritional deficiencies, as you've said. I think when I see my patients, for those who are open to plant-based eating, I've seen some amazing transformations. I've seen people massively reduce their blood pressure. I've seen people improve their perimenopausal symptoms, people improve their asthma, improve their bowel issues, their inflammatory bowel diseases. And well, one gentleman was able to even reverse his low-grade prostate cancer. And I don't say these things lightly. It is really powerful. I think the power of food is tremendous, but it's not a panacea. No, we all get sick and ultimately we all die. And so it's really just about finding ways to increase the amount of plants that we eat. I don't think that everybody in the whole world has to go 100% plant-based in order to get the benefits of eating more plants. And luckily, guidelines across the world agree with that. So, you know, we're looking at the World Cancer Research Fund. It tells us that a cancer preventing diet is essentially vegetables, fruits, whole grains and legumes. They are the cornerstone of a cancer preventing diet. Looking at the American College of Cardiology, they talk about the number one way of preventing heart disease is with a plant-rich diet. The College of Clinical Endocrinologists talk about how a plant-based diet is one of the foundational ways you can prevent type 2 diabetes. And it's not just me talking about that. So I think, although it seems like it's an outlying thing to say, it's actually corroborated by a number of different guidelines. And quite honestly, very few of us even eat the way that the dietary guidelines of our country suggest that we could for optimal health. And I'd be much happier if people even just ate our dietary guidelines. But not many of us do that. So I think we just need to sort of raise the needle when it comes to general health of the population. I don't want to get too sort of caught up on whether people should eat 100% or 90% or 85% or whatever, because at the moment, only 7% of us eat enough fruits and vegetables. So, yeah, I think I'm just aiming to make sure that more people eat more plants.
Yeah, so that's it. The balance really is everything. Would you say that's the most important thing is for people to get the balance right?
Well, yes. And I think it depends where they start from. So, I can think of a patient of mine who's quite elderly and has type 2 diabetes, and he wasn't a cook. He didn't cook his own meals. And so he used to get a lot of ready meals. And so I said to him, well, maybe you could just try some of these ready meals instead, which happened to be plant-based. And he was able to actually reduce his insulin requirements. He's type 2 diabetic. And he had such dramatic improvements that he was actually able to come off insulin entirely because his insulin sensitivity increased because he was eating the plant-based ready meal. Now, you wouldn't necessarily say that that is optimally the best choice of food, but you have to start where somebody is and then work from there. So when you say balance, I think it just depends because different people have different ideas about what balance even means.
That comes to the most important part of the book and of every bit of advice, and you've already shown us that you do it by giving us examples of individual patients. And the point is, there is no one remedy for all in almost anything, and in a holistic approach, that's what you're really looking into, isn't it? And for avoiding the idea that one size fits all in any scenario.
Yes, exactly. Because we are all different. And I think that was the beauty of the plan as well at the back, because some people just won't resonate with some of the book and some people will resonate with other parts. And it, for example, in the outside section, I talk about things like bringing more of nature into the home and avoiding certain things in the home that could cause things like air pollution or plastic exposures, things like that, things that people may not have even thought of, but could be easy wins to help them with their health. So yeah, it's about finding what works for you. And luckily there's a lot of different things you can choose from. It's quite a chunky book.
Yes. And I'm really interested in your thoughts on where we are with sleep and its importance. Some people say that sleep, if above all else, is the thing to focus on prioritizing. A lot of the feedback that I get is that people now worry so much about getting enough sleep that it stops them from sleeping. So I'd love your advice on the importance of sleep in this picture. And to people who are in that situation, I know a lot of people now worry so much about the effects of their insomnia that it just worsens it.
Yeah, I really feel for them. And I have to say, when I was writing this chapter, I was quite mindful of that, because having read books about the importance of sleep that didn't provide you with any ideas of how you could improve your sleep, it just leads to increased anxiety. Yeah. So in this book, I wanted to include actual practical tips that people could try, especially for people who work shift patterns. I think that's really important. But also, I wanted to include something called insomnia-based cognitive behavioral therapy, because I think sometimes the thought patterns that we have around our lack of sleep can be just as damaging as not having sleep and can actually exacerbate the lack of sleep. So I wanted to say, I mean, there's two kinds of person that would read the book. The first kind would be the kind that didn't necessarily know how important sleep was, hadn't prioritized it, And then they'd read it, they think, oh, okay, I really should prioritize it. I'm going to do some of these tips. And the second type of person is that person suffering with chronic insomnia think they've tried everything and are just extremely anxious about the lack of sleep that they have. So the insomnia-focused CBT section of the sleep chapter is where I want those people to go, because it's a really interesting insight into the thought patterns around lack of sleep and some of the thoughts that we all have when we're struggling to sleep, which can get quite catastrophic. You know, you can, in the middle of the night, when you're struggling to sleep, you can say, oh, you know, you can say all sorts of negative things to yourself about how it's pointless trying to get back to sleep now, and I'm not going to be able to function in the morning, and I know that I'm going to be killing myself prematurely because I'm lying here awake. And all of these thought processes that can actually be quite damaging for us. And so in the book, I talk about some more helpful thoughts that you can have around the lack of sleep that you're experiencing. And also I give people just a bit of an idea about what insomnia-focused CBT involves. And if it's something that they want to try, they can try and do some of the exercises themselves. But I would recommend seeing a insomnia CBT expert for that if you're really struggling.
Very elementary question, but in terms of sleep, do you think that there is a number of hours recommended for all, or is it again a question of everybody's different?
Everyone's different to an extent. I think anywhere between sort of 6 and 8 hours is usually considered to be ideal. Some people need more, some people need less. We need more sleep, obviously, in childhood and moving through into adolescence. And we tend to need less sleep in our dotage. But yeah, I think probably somewhere between 6 and 8 is ideal.
If you had to prescribe one of the, it's a bit mean this, isn't it? But could you, if you had to prescribe to everybody in your special Dr. Gemma Newman bottle, one of the 6 things, would there be one that stood out?
Yes, love. Of course, love is the one, I think, because love is, I believe, the cardinal emotion, and it does trump fear, and it does trump polarity and negativity. And it's the emotion that helps us to tap into our very best selves, for ourselves and for others. And yeah, it's really foundational to feeling good about yourself and what you have to offer the world. So yeah, it has to be love.
Wonderful. Okay. Not a question so much from Charles. He said, I wish I could consult Gemma. A lovely breath of fresh air. Would she care to offer comment on the wisdom of using statins? In particular, I'd have a scientific reference which cast doubt on their claimed efficacy.
So I actually had this question yesterday. Look, I think in my clinical practice, I use statins regularly, and there are a number of benefits of statins over and above their ability to reduce our cholesterol. They certainly can also reduce other pathways of inflammation in the body. I have seen tremendous improvements in my patients by bringing their cholesterol down using the power of a plant-based diet. I've seen it in myself, actually. We haven't gone into this today, but I had a consistently raised cholesterol myself. It's a familial high cholesterol that I have. And the only time I've ever managed to bring it to normal was when I went plant-based, just because you're essentially removing saturated fat from the diet. I mean, obviously not completely. There are certain things like palm oil that have saturated fat, and coconut oil has an element of saturated fat. But basically, predominantly in most of our diets, saturated fats tend to come from junk foods and animal products. So I was able to dramatically improve my cholesterol, and it's certainly something that you can see in the evidence base. You can bring cholesterol down very well using diet. However, it's not always enough for everybody to just use dietary methods. And I think there is clear data to show that having a raised lipid profile is a very clear risk factor for heart disease. And so I have no qualms in recommending statins for my patients as well as lifestyle changes.
It's really interesting you were sort of saying some of those oils, and another interview that we did recently with a gentleman, Andrew Jenkinson, was saying something that struck me when I look now at many of the plant-based milk alternatives and generally plant-based alternatives. It is important, isn't it, for people to increasingly scrutinize what goes into those, because the popularity of plant-based and people thinking it's an immediately healthier option is something to be wary of because of what's in certain plant-based foods that certainly isn't good for you.
Yes, I think it's helpful to look at ingredients in general. That being said, I think that there's actually a lot of interesting bias actually against certain plant-based products, which I find quite fascinating. So for example, when we look at the plant-based meat alternatives, it's true to say that some of them will contain coconut oil, which has saturated fat. Some of them will contain more salt, which is not great for your blood pressure. But when you actually look at studies such as the Swap Meat Trial, and there was another one as well done by a colleague and a friend looking at one of the UK-based alternative meat products, it's clear that there are still advantageous changes to your microbiome when you consume these compared to when you consume like organic meats, and there are changes to your blood pressure. There are positive changes as well to your weight potentially. And I think, you know, yes, there is definitely an element of processing, which I think I can understand people feeling, especially the current zeitgeist is very much against ultra processed foods. Some of the plant-based alternatives are ultra processed. Some of them are not ultra processed. And I think there is an element of processing in a lot of our foods, and not all of it is harmful. For example, tofu technically is processed, but it's extremely healthy. And according to the NOVA classification of what's processed and what's unprocessed and what's ultra processed, there's a number of really healthy things that are mildly to moderately processed that we would clearly find healthy foods. So I think it's about trying to look at some of the nuance and some of the actual data that we have on whether something is healthy or not, rather than sort of necessarily jumping to an instinctive conclusion on that. And it's also important whenever you look at anything in nutrition to think about compared to what. So for example, if you were having, a bean and lentil burger, that's probably going to be a healthier choice than a Beyond burger, but that's going to be a much healthier choice than a McDonald's beef burger, for example. So it's about thinking, well, you know, what were you going to consume? And if you're going to consume something else, how does it compare?
It's so interesting to have your perspective on this in so many ways. I wish we had more time. But actually on that, I thought the questions might, people might be fascinated. And Lauren asks, I'm vegan and struggle to get enough daily protein. I'm currently adding protein powder to my morning smoothie, but can you suggest other sources that aren't excessively high in carbs as well, as I don't want to gain weight?
So,
and you have great recipes in the book. I must say there are some absolutely delicious and simple sounding recipes.
Well, yeah. You know, that's true. And also, should I say, there is a QR code in the book, because
yes.
One of the things I wanted to, you know, get away from is it can feel quite boring if you've got a black and white book and you've got recipes in it. You don't necessarily feel like you want to make them because you can't see what they look like. So I've got a QR code. There you go. So
yes, here we go. It looks like this.
Yeah, you just tap on the QR code and you get to see photographs of all these gorgeous recipes. And it's not just me. It's Deliciously Ella, Rupi Orjla, the Happy Pear Chefs, and a cordon bleu trained vegan chef, as well as my mum and my recipes. And they're all kind of in there. So to answer the question, there's quite a lot of assumptions there about carbohydrates. So it's not necessarily that carbohydrates will automatically result in weight gain, which I think has been, again, a really popular way of thinking over the years. And it's something that I used to believe as well years ago. I think, oh, you've got to cut the carbs in order to stay trim. But when we look at the how the body processes our macronutrients, proteins, carbohydrates, fats, they're all needed. And, you know, sometimes having a certain amount of healthy carbohydrates is actually really important for satiety, and for improving your GLP-1 levels, which is what the weight loss injections aim to increase, that can also be increased, believe it or not, by eating more satiating, minimally processed carbohydrates. So just the thought that you don't necessarily have to completely avoid carbohydrates. And in addition to that, I think my favorite sources of protein, I mean, it's a great idea to add protein into your smoothie. That's a wonderful, easy win. But also things like scrambled tofu is a great option. Beans, bean burritos, lentils, chickpeas, nuts and seeds as well have got high protein, but also they've got really healthy monounsaturated and polyunsaturated fats. Those are all really great options for you.
Oh, we've got literally sort of, as you said, time flies past so fast, and we've got sort of 2 minutes, and it reminds me that we left a little bit hanging when we were talking about the power of letting go and love. And I think, you said love was what you would prioritize. And it's a mixture of so many loves of others, and particularly self-compassion, to be able to let go. I just wonder if you could describe and explain the very physical effects that it can have on a person's body, being able to let go of whatever it is that's, well, eating away at them is a expression that comes to mind.
Yeah, absolutely. It can be so healing for our bodies and our minds. When we look at where love is felt in the body, this is probably slightly off-piste, but I think it's incredible when we think about our own hearts, how our heart generates its own electricity, and how the electric field of our heart is higher in amplitude to the electric field of our brain by about 60 times. And the magnetic field of our heart is about 100 times greater than the magnetic field of our brain. And these things, we measure with ECGs and EEGs, and you can actually feel the electromagnetic field that your heart produces up to a meter outside your body. And emotions such as love and joy and compassion expand that electromagnetic field, and they can therefore provide you with a number of amazing health benefits. And it's something that's quite hard to measure, but I've seen it time and again in my patients that when they're able to really embrace those emotions, they can feel better physically and mentally.
As Charles says, I bet everybody listening, watching, wishes that they could walk straight into your consulting room tomorrow, because your advice is, as I said at the start, very gentle and very wise. So thank you very much. There's a lot more in your fantastic book, which people can, of course, get their hands on, and the recipes and going out, what they can do in nature, and it's all very accessible, as I said. But we've touched on just enough, I hope. Thank you so much, and thank you all very much indeed for being with us.
Thank you, Hannah, and thank you, everybody. I've had a wonderful time.
This episode of the podcast starred Dr. Gemma Newman and was presented by Hannah McInnes. This show is produced by me and Nicole Wong in London. It's edited while we sleep in the US and Australia by John Doughty. We're back on Tuesday. Until next time, I'm Vas Krishnadoulou. Thanks for listening.